Bonsoir. How are you, dear friends? We are building the most inspiring and phenomenal communities of wine lovers. As we all know, wine is the catalyst of the greatest discussion. We'll be talking wine, but of course food, and everything that touches all our nation and senses. Bonjour, bonsoir, dear friends. Welcome to JCB Live. Tonight will be a happy hour live and so exciting because we have a very charismatic, extremely interesting, all true Californian who came from Southern California with a dream in mind. Conquer the mountain. Be on the hilltop and showcase to the world that we can make great wines. Stu and his brother created one of the most amazing winery on Spring Mountain, named Smith Madron Winery. And they really proved to the world that it's possible to make phenomenal wines on the hills of Napa. This is gonna be a fun conversation, talking about the life of Southern California, moving to Napa Valley, creating a great family story, and of course, crafting a very iconic wines, following environmental practices, great winemaking, and being true to what we love the most in wine, what the French say, the terroir. Voila! Woo-hoo-hoo! This is actually perfect, Stu. This is a good introduction for you to come. I know I will get a little wipe shortly.
I will hold my glass out right away.
Absolutely. Well, Stu, I'm very excited that you came down from your
Cheers.
Fabulous mountain. Thank you to come to the heart of our secret place in Napa to be with me, because with this period of time we live in, we don't see each other in person that much.
We don't. It's unfortunate.
So you have to welcome you a Burgundy JCB 21, which is a Chardonnay Pinot Noir blend, which is mysterious like you, radiant and luminous like your wine.
By the way, do you know why we clink glasses?
Well, I'd love to hear your version.
My version is that we bring all of the senses into presence when we drink wine, with the exception of sound.
Ah.
And so we clink to bring that last element in. So we have
it.
Taste, sight, smell, sound.
I was always convinced that in the old days, we look at each other in the eye too, because there was poison. And eventually we would poison one another, and here we go. Well, let's do it again, because I've heard as well in California, you always say, you look at it at yourself in the eyes, right? Why is that?
I've never heard that.
Dear friends, 7 years of apparently bad sex, so who wants that? So Stu, you born and raised in Southern Cal.
Yes.
In this amazing place.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about it a few years ago, how fantastic it was, and what took you to Northern Cal.
Well, I grew up in Santa Monica. I think it was fifth grade, my parents let myself and my best friend take the bus down to the beach. And we spent all day, all summer at the beach. And I learned to surf when I was in sixth grade.
A true beach boy, is
that? Yeah, and we would take our father's army jackets from World War II, wear them because in the wintertime it was cold. And then if you remember, I don't know if people are old enough to remember this, but you'd get a canister when you got your film from Kodak.
For sure.
Okay, so we would steal booze, fill the can up with booze, drop them in our shorts, and we'd paddle out and drink, and because that's the way you stayed warm in the wintertime.
I love it. Well, that helps you with the sharks.
There weren't many sharks back then.
Yeah. Your father served in the World War II?
Oh, yeah.
What was he?
He was a weatherman.
Oh, great. Key a weatherman, because this is what, you know, D-Day was.
Well, he was on the Pacific, and he was on a troop ship going to Japan when peace was declared. So fortunately for me, he survived as, and thus I'm here.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, to him,
yes,
as a Frenchman, because whether it was the Pacific or the Atlantic, America was well needed to create such a success.
So yes.
I'm French thanks to you. So Stu, from Southern Cal, you discovered Napa Valley.
Well, what happened is
tell
that
us the story.
Yeah, I went to Berkeley in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was unique in a way in that as most college kids drink beer.
Yeah.
And I discovered I liked wine better.
At college?
At college. And I had a lot of, I met a number of friends who came from the Napa Valley, went up and visited and liked it. And thought to myself, when I graduate, am I going to go back to Southern California or am I going to go north and try to find a way to get into the wine business?
Oh, really? So at college, you already knew that's going to be wine.
Right. As a matter of fact, as a senior, the fall of my senior class, I became what was called an intercampus exchange student, which means that if you go to any UC, you can take classes at any other UC if you can get to them.
I see.
And Berkeley and Davis were relatively close, and speed limit was what it was. And so I took the introductory class, loved it, started taking chemistry classes and all the prerequisites that I should have had I wanted to do this in the first place.
Sure.
And applied for graduate school. As I like to say, through a clerical error, I was admitted.
Through a clerical error.
Yeah.
I doubt that. You seem to be a very good chemist, too.
So
that's amazing because it's unusual when we think about a lot of the wonderful California winemakers like you. They did something else before, and then they thought wine would be interesting, and they moved into it. So you from college, that was it.
Well, I had that idea, and I looked at the industry, and it was a very small industry. And what people don't understand, in 1969, 1970, 71, those... Napa Valley was a small provincial agricultural backwater community.
Yeah, for sure.
It wasn't anywhere near the sophistication that it is today.
Yeah.
And the Cuisinart hadn't been invented. For those old enough, the oil embargo hadn't occurred. The inflation that practically destroyed the economies of the world hadn't occurred yet. So all of those things happened. And if you were young and you had a dream, And just a middle class kid, you can make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And those days are gone.
But I hope our friends are listening. If you have a dream, you can make it happen. And I love
that's
this.
Right. But so many people like myself who I was a bricks and mortar guy.
Yeah.
And there's different ways of getting into the industry today. You don't have to be bricks and mortar, but back then bricks and mortar was the only way you could get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I looked at Joe Heitz.
Yeah.
And Joe Heitz became kind of my model,
mm-hmm.
in that he had taught and then started the winery and made the two things work together. And I was weighing this issue of going back to Southern California, trying to make my fortune and then buy my way into the industry like so many people do today.
So what's your expression again? You start with a large fortune?
And the way you make a small fortune in the wine industry is start with a large one. And I used to teach. I taught for 12 years viticulture and enology over at Santa Rosa Junior College and a couple years down at Napa. And I used to say to the people in the audience who were trying to get into the wine business, I said, look, and this is my economics background. Look, if you want to make money, go buy McDonald's franchises or two or three. And then you can retire to the Bahamas and live a grand lifestyle. But if you're going to try to get into the wine business and there, what happens is the winery says, feed me. Give me more money.
She's a hungry beast.
Yeah, and it's a beast it is.
Yeah.
And we have this strange deal that we think wineries should feed us, not feed, we're not supposed to feed the winery, except in the beginning, like children. But this, and jumping around here, one of the interesting things about Napa Valley today is that I think of it as kind of the Italian Renaissance.
Uh-huh.
My Duomo is bigger than your Duomo.
Mm-hmm.
My church painter is more famous than your church painter. And really, what is a winery?
Yeah.
It is grapes come in and hopefully really good wine goes out.
Like this one.
Like this one.
So very true. So it's very inspiring. Because,
by the way, this is lovely.
Thank you. Well, we wanted to have you try something different.
I like different.
And now, dear friends, I know we're making you jealous, but you know you could get all those wines at the Oak Dog Grocery, of course, and at Smith Madrone Winery directly as well. This is the Chardonnay we're going to be trying as we hear from education to building the winery. So how is it to build a winery from scratch?
You fall back on some cliches that you didn't know applied at the time. And one of them is ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
Because if I knew then what I know now, there is no way in hell I would ever have the courage to do what it is that I did. But you just get up one day and you just keep doing it, and you go to bed thinking about doing work. You get up thinking about work. You're trying to get to work and do it. And my brother and I literally built the winery ourselves with our own hands.
That's so cool.
And in fact, one of the interesting stories that you can identify with, the winery is going to be poured in three slabs. So we poured the two outside slabs, and I'm looking over here and I'm looking at this vacant piece of dirt, and I'm going, if we don't get underground now, I don't think we'll ever get underground. So I said to my brother, why don't we build a cellar down here and get underground? He goes, that's a good idea.
Makes a ton of sense.
So I called the building inspector, told him what we were doing. And he says, and I said, what do we got to do? He says, well, sketch it out in 8.5 by 11, maybe Thursday at 10 o'clock at the county buildings, and bring a check. So $120 later, and I don't think I had 8 hours in driving down there and driving back, I had my permit.
I want to toast to this. Today, those 8 hours takes 8 years.
8 years, if you're lucky.
Well, well done.
Yeah.
So you drew it on a piece of paper.
And then we had a backhoe, and we dug it out, and we poured a slab, and then we put the bricks, you know, the block up, and poured a ceiling, and then built the rest of the winery.
Very cool. So what year was that?
We started with our permit in 74.
Okay. Same time as Raymond Vineyards, really.
And I have a connection. They lent us their stemmer crusher after they'd used and abused it. And that's how a little guy like us survived.
That's wonderful.
Through largesse from people like, you know, Walt Raymond.
Yeah.
And we ended up buying all of the used equipment that everybody goes, I'm tired of this. I'm going, I'm interested.
Yeah.
So I got the overhead conveyor from the Mondavis at Charles Krug, and I bought the receiving hopper from Schramsberg, and I got the stemmer crusher out on Hudson Avenue.
I told you Smith and Madrone Winery is a museum.
Yeah.
You could see everybody there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, listen, well, we go way back.
But this is very cool. In many ways, we think we should get the latest bells and whistles. In fact, the more sophisticated the wine is, the more simpler it's made. And we back into cement tanks. We back into open oval fermenters like the monks used in Burgundy, 11th century. So let's not always think that the next new thing is better than the old.
And in fact, one time I was down at one of our machine shops about 8-10 years ago, and I was talking to one of the guys there that runs the yard, and we were talking about stuff. And I said, "Well, things slow for you?" "Oh, no, we're doing real well. We're building all these fancy machines for these new people. You know, the folks that sold their widget factory in Silicon Valley, and they want to get in the wine business." And I go, and tell me about it. And he says, well, everybody looks at it and says, you know that piece of machinery down in so-and-so? Yeah. We want one just like it, but we want it fancier. And I go, do they ask the price? And he goes, nah, not a bit.
Here it is. Welcome to the new Napa.
So back to the Chardonnay.
Yeah, because
let me jump in here.
Absolutely stellar. Congratulations.
So it's a good place for us to describe our philosophy of wine.
Please. Yes.
And that is, we're a little bit more European than Californian. We believe that after 7,000-8,000 years, the Europeans have kind of a lot of stuff right.
Yeah.
And that is balance, complexity, elegance, restraint, sophistication. All these words are really hard to define, but in total, I think they do make a definition. As opposed to, we were in this huge period in California of what we describe as OTT,
yeah,
over the top.
For sure.
And we like acidity, and balance and complexity. And really, the first obligation of wine is to give pleasure.
Yeah.
If it doesn't give pleasure, you've lost the battle right from the get-go.
But this level of acidity as well.
Love acidity.
Well, yeah.
Without acidity, you're dealing with a dull, lifeless object. There's no bright eyes in it. There's no brightness. There's no fun. There's no zip. There's no zing.
Well said.
And that is the part which is so important, which so much of California is losing out on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are saying the millennials aren't paying attention to wine. Well, yeah, because the wine's boring.
Yeah. So where do you make, where is the vineyard of this?
The vineyard is at 1,900 feet in elevation at the very top of Spring Mountain, which is just west of St. Helena.
Yeah, so let's talk about, mountain vineyards, because obviously coming from the old world, we love hillsides, not only in the Côte du Rhône, but in Burgundy as well, and certainly in the south. Here, many people don't think we can perform so well in the mountains. So give us your philosophy, your approach, and why as well. Three questions in one.
Right.
You chose Spring Mountain.
Well, it really goes back several thousands of years to Virgil wrote a treatise on farming.
Yes.
And in it, he talked about growing olives.
Yes.
And he talked about growing wine grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And he complained bitterly about all of the hand labor that goes into growing wine grapes.
Mm.
But he came up with the saying, which is Bacchus amat colus.
Yeah.
Bacchus loves the hills.
That's right.
Because all things being equal, being tried to be politically correct, or at least it's not too far incorrect, we believe that the best grapes are, all things being equal, are grown in the mountains because they have to struggle.
That's right.
They have to work harder. They have to put their roots really down deep and fight to make those grapes get ripe. And I do believe also that the fruit goes from a vegetative cycle to a ripening cycle more naturally if they are non-irrigated, dry farm, or at least ways minimally irrigated.
That's Virgil at its best.
Yes.
Dear
Ooh,
friends,
I like that.
This is a history lesson. Well, for your wine, only crystal.
Aha.
So we designed this glass, in fact, with Baccarat, as you can see. So big opening, mm-hmm. 9.5 mm-hmm. centimeters, mm-hmm. 8.5 on the top with a lip. So you just move your elbow and it goes right in the middle of your tongue. In the umami space, which I think with your Smith Madrone Chardonnay works beautifully because the wine goes horizontally and vertically.
It does.
So this is an amazing wine, dear friends. And you think of Spring Mountain, typically, or a lot of people may, about red wine, but the whites are amazing. And we have a surprise, as you'll see, for the end of the tasting, with a great Riesling as well.
Let me also say one other thing about Chardonnay, and it's all our wines, but it works especially well with Chardonnay, and that is that as the grower and the winemaker and the site all go into the wine, mm-hmm. we think it's our job to get the vintage into the glass of wine.
For sure.
And that's why we vintage date, which is to celebrate the diversity of the vintages, and we abhor the concept of pounding the square peg through the round hole.
Yep.
And everything we make, we grow.
Mm-hmm.
We don't buy anybody else's grapes.
And how many acres you have up there?
There's about 38. Well, we're in a little bit of a replanting, but we have 38.5 acres dedicated to vineyard.
Yeah. And as you are seeing, as we're speaking, a spectacular sight. Hillsides, rolling hills, 1,900 feet of altitude. This is kind of the dream. So, maybe, Stu, before many more questions as well on you, and one of the questions I'd love to ask you as I serve you, maybe, yes, so you could pour in here. Yes, perfect. I like that. You see, I always finish my glass. I don't believe in, getting rid of such beautiful wine unless it is in a vinegar barrel. Well, I got the mother from my great-grandmother, and this is one of the best vinegar on earth. That's the only way I get rid of the wine. If not, use your œsophage. That's the best way. So, Stu, this is a, almost hillside as well, not as high as yours. This is at the entrance of Napa Valley in the Vacas Mountain. Mm-hmm. And this is one of our estate that the Raymond planted.
Okay.
It actually, you mentioned 74, in 1974 as well. And they planted this Chardonnay adjacent to a great Sauvignon Blanc. So We wanted to serve you this wine for several reasons. One, you love history, obviously. You really represent California, and this is from 1881 Napa, which is that first store ever built named the Oakville Grocery, where your wines are. So, to the history of this amazing state.
Yes.
So, before we go back to wine, what makes you who you are today, you think?
Interesting question. Lots of different things. One is that going to Berkeley was very important to me.
Yeah.
And again, it gave me that overall view of being a macroeconomist.
Well, in a phenomenal school.
Well, it was a good school.
Right. World acclaimed.
Well, it was a very interesting time in the mid-60s, too.
Stu, side note. I went on an interview, graduate school at Berkeley, among others.
Right.
And I was very French, very cream trousers, blazer, bow tie. You know, I was 22 years old. And I sit on the bench, I'm 2 hours early because, you know, you're shaking, you're going for the actual interview of the acceptance or not. And there's a woman sitting next to me with three pigs on a leash. And I'm looking at her and say, you gotta be joking. And she says, oh yeah, this is Helen, this is Robert, and this is, you know, another name. And they're my pets, they live with me at home. And they actually have a little space in the kitchen. And they're my family. And I talked to her for 30 minutes and I said, maybe I'll go south. So I did reverse. I went to UCLA when you went to Berkeley, maybe okay. For those
well,
reasons.
Well, I will give you one quick little snippet of the time. I was in Navy ROTC at the time and I learned to shoot 45s underneath the girls' gym at UC Berkeley.
Ooh.
In 1966.
I love that. Is it still there?
No. I took Julianne, my wife, and I took our daughter there to visit Cal, and it was right across the new building that we started out in. It was right across from where the girls' gym was, and that room is gone.
Uh-huh.
Gone, completely gone.
But anyhow, I'm sure there's a lot more stories that Stu would share.
So anyway, you asked about what formed me. So then I went to Davis. That taught me the details of things. And then I read vociferously. I'm a slow reader, but I read. We get three newspapers delivered every morning. We get the Napa Valley Register, which is where I start. I go to the Chronicle, which is a little further away, and the New York Times, further away. And it's something I've done all the way through from high school is reading newspapers, and it is it's just part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is that I love reading, and books have formed a big part of my life. C.S. Forrester did a whole history, a series on Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah.
I probably read the series three times.
Good for you.
And that was a big moral compass for me. And then the other part of me is Boy Scouts.
Yes. And you've served for many years. I still am. You still are.
I'm the committee chair for our little scout Troop 1.
Great.
In St. Helena. And those all had influence on me.
For sure.
And the other one is that, back to the wine industry, when I started, I had to get a permit from CDF, California Department of Forestry, to reclaim the vineyard. The vineyard had been there in the 1880s, put in by George Cook, and it had overgrown.
Okay.
The forest, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and the forest came back in. And we had to get a logging permit because the trees were 80, 90 feet old, 2.5 feet in diameter. We ended up logging 1 million board feet out of the property.
Hmm.
So when I went over to get the permit, this forester looks at me and he goes, kid, I know you think you know what you're doing, but you don't. And
that's a good start of a conversation.
Very good start. And he said, as soon as you fire up your first chainsaws to log the property, the crazies are going to come out after you.
Yeah.
And I said, no, sir. I'm a newly minted, you know, UC Davis dude. This is a good project. This is good for the forest. I knew then that the forests were overgrown.
Yes.
That by clearing out some little areas, There would be fire breaks that could stop a tremendous forest fire.
Very important today.
Yeah, it's very important today. So I knew all of that. And I said, look, it's good for the economy for Napa Valley. This is the future of Napa Valley. Agriculture is important. Mm-hmm. This is a product that goes back, you know, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years.
Correct.
This is a win-win. He goes, go for it. He was right. I was wrong. They came after me with a vengeance.
Really?
Absolutely. And it scarred me. Huh. And it made me, in a lot of ways, who I am today, because at that time, people called up and claimed that I was going to build a hotel and a resort on top of Spring Mountain. And I'm going, are you guys out of your ever-loving brain? And it has made me...
New expression for me.
It has made me distrust and dislike environmental organizations ever since. Hmm. I consider myself a conservationist. There's nobody who will do more to protect the land than I will.
Yes.
But I have, that was a period of my life where I learned a really hard lesson in a very short period of time.
And how, as I serve you, one of my favorite wine that you produce, of course, how do you overcome such a difficult obstacle? Because I could see in your eyes it was a tough one. Because in life, and a lot of our friends with us today, we all face difficult times. How did you win it over and put it behind you?
Well, one, I use science.
Yeah.
And two, I am tenacious as hell.
Yes.
There's no way that we should be able to do what we are doing. Give you an example. In 1990, we were in the middle, we were doing an IPO.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know that we did this back then, but we were doing an IPO. And in the middle of a bottling run.
Dear friends, initial public offering, one of the first ever, because very little IPO in the wine world in the United States at the time. Right. So very innovative.
And that's what we do. I'm always out in front. Yeah. So what we tried to do was to do an IPO, and we were bottling. And because I believe in environmentalism, I was using used recycled bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And 3/4 through the run of our Chardonnay, somebody said, bottles look dirty. So we shut down the line, and sure enough, there were bottles that were dirty. And so we called up the supplier, and they said, "Fine, we'll ship up wine and get it to you." And we did that. And anyway, the bottom line is, I called my insurance company and said, "Yeah, you're right. To me, you can't sell the wine, and by the way, you're not insured for it."
Hmm.
And that ended up in a litigation that went on for many years. And let me just say to anybody who ever wants to litigate, don't do it. Find a way to settle first. It is a terrible way to make money.
I agree with you.
And that was another kind of niche in the armor of this thing, because we tried to do the right thing.
But you never went public, finally.
We did not.
We did not. Which is probably a good idea.
Well, it was a blessing.
That's right.
It was a blessing. But at the time, we had the accountants look at me and say, there is no way that you can, on paper, survive this.
Hmm.
We know you will survive because, which is to your question, you are so goddamn tenacious.
Yes.
You will simply not stop.
And that's what it takes, dear friends, as you all know, to be a true entrepreneur is you got to be stubborn, you got to be inflexible sometimes, and very tenacious.
Right.
So, to tenacity and you and your brother. So, let's develop further Cabernet, mm-hmm. Spring Mountain, and maybe tell us about this vineyard, this wine.
Well, first of all, Spring Mountain is because there are a lot of springs up there.
Yep.
That's our source of water, is springs.
Sure.
It's not a mountain. It is a geographical area. Yeah. There's no Spring Mountain. It's just an area where they've been growing grapes for the last 140 years.
Yeah.
And it's been called Spring Mountain. Again, why I went to the mountains is because I wanted to make the very best wine humanly possible. And I found this property that was immediately upslope and to the west of Stony Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, Keenan has come in,
sure.
And they are west of us and just a titch above us. Kenan is to the south along the same ridge as we are now. They are now with us. And
a lot of great wineries. Spring Mountain is a magical place.
It is a magical place.
And maybe some of us who were watching television, you probably remember a famous TV show which even crossed the boundaries named Falcon Crest.
Yes.
Was filmed on
Spring Mountain, at Spring Mountain Winery. And it is a lovely, beautiful Victorian. If I can remember, it was designed by the same fellow that did the Rheinhaus for Behringer.
Oh, beautiful.
And Parrott, Tribusio Parrott, was right. The one who owned the property and built it. And I don't know very much about him other than occasionally I come across his name.
Yeah. It's a magical place. So you make those wines which have a very delicate palate. You know,
we have learned to tame the mountain because, again, we have this European view of the world.
Yes.
These elements that I won't go over again. And so much of mountain viticulture can be a little heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Too much tannin, too much this, too much of that.
Yeah.
And so we really strive for this elegance and balance and complexity. The other thing about being in the mountains is that nothing's easy. It is all hard. We were originally going to build the winery.
Just to have a simple life, it's not the place to go.
It's not. So we were originally going to build the winery out of rock.
Yeah.
But my brother and I spent summers after summers just picking up rocks. Rocks, rocks, rocks. And the idea of picking those rocks up and making it into a winery was like, we're done with rocks. We hate rocks. If rocks had value.
Can you imagine two brothers, you know? Chirk, chirk.
If rocks had value, we would be wealthy beyond anybody's imagination. So what we did is we built the winery out of a split face block. And then what
which
we did too, which nobody has done but us, and that is we took every block and we took a cement chisel and we whacked every goddamn block and turned it over and whacked it again.
Wow.
And then we set it into place.
Fantastic.
So that it had more relief, that it had more character.
For
and
sure.
That's what we want.
And
that's
your fingerprints on every rock.
Everything of it. Fingernails, too. and that's kind of the concept that you have to have when we talked about how do you make great wine. You have to have a mindset which is unassailable, unchallengeable, and you just have to go and go and go for it.
And congratulations, I love the fact that you dry farmed. As you know, in France, prime example, we don't allow irrigation. And either it's natural, it's going to work or it's not. And
right.
Don't do vineyards where you don't. And I think in Napa Valley in California, you're conservationist of water, which is so important. Water is the next oil in many respects. And going dry farm, as you explained so well, gives the personality, the identity of that rootstock going deep.
Yes.
Very, very important. And I think a lot of us should look for dry farm vineyards. Because it makes wine with character, personality. And when Stu make the wine, as you see the character, you know the wine has it.
You know, the other thing I'll say in all of this, and that is that, you know, I mentioned three wineries that are our neighbors, Stony Hill, Barnett, and Kenan. And when you look at the word terroir, we in the New World mostly use and change it to a sense of place.
Yeah.
I think it's a little different. I call it an ephemeral sense of art.
Yep, I like that definition.
Because every winery, small winery especially, if they don't make something which is unique to them as the grape grower, them as the winemaker, then it is the site and the soil, they're failed.
Yeah.
It has to be unique. Now, it has to be uniquely good, but it has to be unique.
Totally
agree. If my wine is just like Kendall Jackson or Robert Mondavi, I have failed. I have no reason to exist.
That's right.
They can make it cheaper, faster, better than I can. But I can do something they can't do.
Stu, I'm so much with you. I've always said that the beauty of wineries, whether it's Burgundy, Bordeaux, Napa Valley, Sonoma, it's a museum that you can visit each time.
Yes.
And every artist opens their door to their gallery. And here in this case, you have the expression of you and your brother. So what did you bring there in that gorgeous bottle?
This one?
Well, there's two, but
this
what
one
is
yes.
wrapped
this
beautifully
is,
by hand.
This is what, if I may use a French term, our tête de cuvée.
Ooh. You see, Stu reminds me where I come from. Beaucoup, tête de cuvée, sacré bleu.
So this is what we call Cook's Flat Reserve.
Yes.
And starting in, in the early aughts, we were looking at an awful lot of wines that were being made from California for a great deal of money, and we're going, we can do better than that. And so finally with the 2007 vintage, we came out and did it.
Wow.
And the tissue wrap is a reproduction.
Oh, be careful. Right? Yeah,
is a re- you spilled, I can spill.
Yeah, that's right, I did spill. But it was refreshing, wasn't it?
Was it was refreshing, okay.
And then your lovely wife tonight is going to say, my love, you smell like JCB21 fragrance. You're going to be full of bubbles. You're going to be sweating Chardonnay and Pinot from Burgundy.
So what?
I'll give you some bottles to do a bathtub out of.
Oh, great. So what we did is George Cook was the first legal owner of the property. He homesteaded it. And this is the label.
Gorgeous presentation.
Each bottle is numbered.
Yep.
And so this is
Cook's Flat.
The document that George got from the United States Land Office to own the property. And in doing it and improving it, he cleared the property and planted olive trees. So we have olive trees.
Really?
We have the biggest olive trees anybody's ever seen.
Wow.
The 30, 35, 40 feet tall. And what happened is, as the vineyard was abandoned, the Douglas fir trees grew 80, 90 feet, 100 feet tall right through them. And so they had to compete for sunlight, so they grew.
Yes.
And when we cleared the property, we were very careful about cutting down the oaks, the madrones, the poison oak, and preserve those olive trees.
Congratulations. Well, and that's a magnificent idea.
Isn't it? It's just beautiful.
And another good sound?
Yes. Now, this wine is designed to be competitive with the first gross of France. This is what we have in our gun sights, is Latour, Lafite, Aubryon, Margaux. And it is very different from most California wines.
Magical.
And when you make a wine and you have an idea, you have to start from the very beginning, as I've said with everything else. And then it all flows through the concept and through the brain and into the execution of it. And a lot of people will say, well, wait a minute. It's kind of an arrogant thing to do.
Why not? No.
But why not? You got to start somewhere.
You got to start with an objective.
Right. They may have a 400 or 500 year head start on us, but what the hell?
You catch up pretty fast in America. We're learning from you today. So, Stu, as you're going to describe the wine in a moment, what is your passion?
My passion is right there. Right there. That's it.
Very consistent.
Right there.
I can feel it.
Right there. That's it.
Dear friends, there's vibration on this gold table. This is passionate.
That is passion. It's what keeps me up. It's what gets me, I come home, I'm tired, I get up in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's what I try to spend Sunday at home. Mm-hmm. As I like to say, why aren't we open on Sundays? Because if I don't stay home with my family on Sunday, I won't have a family to go home to.
That's right. So, as you describe this wine, give our friends the identity of Spring Mountain as well. That, I think, speaks volume in this glass. This is one of the most
don't forget
charismatic wine I've tried
of Spring. That the Cabernet is a 16. This is also a 16.
Yep.
So, they're two very different. This is a little bit more California.
Yep.
Not to say that it's all California, but there is California that comes through it.
Sure.
This, I think, could be from
totally
anywhere.
Well, it could be very French.
Right.
That's for sure.
Exactly.
As you said earlier.
So, back to your question, which was?
What is your passion?
My passion. I already told you.
Your passion.
It's in the glass.
It's in the glass.
It's in the glass.
Well, maybe.
And growing. You know what? It's also growing of the grapes.
Yeah.
You can't be passionate as a winemaker if you're not passionate about growing the grapes.
That's for sure.
Because at the very bottom of this pyramid is farming. And the land and the soil. And if you're not willing to get in and get your fingernails dirty, you're missing huge part of what the wine is.
And people are realizing more and more than ever, I feel, that wine is made in the vineyards, as we've always said.
Always.
You know, and here, you know, congratulations for building this amazing vision. on the very top of Spring Mountain. So, Stu, what's your dream?
Interesting.
Now we're getting deep, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. Well,
we want to get under this
beautiful
beard.
Besides Sophia Loren?
Well, that's a good dream, too. Well, maybe in addition to Sophia
Loren. Dreams, let me first say, dreams are there to provide pleasure.
Yep.
And they don't have to always come to fruition.
That's true.
For years.
And they keep you going.
They keep you going. And for years, I had dreams of going and seeing and hiking to Machu Picchu.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow. Of seeing the Acropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And those are still important dreams. But for me, I also have other dreams that are more immediate. One of them is, and it's a strange dream, a desire, and that is to, while I'm still alive, be able to build a log cabin on the property from trees that I personally cut down, that I shave, that I get to put into place.
That's great.
Now, it's not going to be a great, elegant Montana or Wyoming log home. But it would be a small personal cabin.
Well, that's what counts.
That I get to do by myself, and for me, doing things by my, you know, with my own hands.
That's right.
Is important.
You're a creator. You're a builder.
I enjoy that. It's I had to make a decision as to whether I'm going to grow grapes and make wine, or do some other things, and mostly. Wine is a terrible taskmaster.
Mm-hmm.
There is never enough time. The other dream that I have is that we have this beautiful, we call the Wedding Grove,
yes,
that looks out over all of the Upper Valley. And it's got near, mid, and far distances. And people say, why don't we build a home there?
Yeah.
And my attitude is, it's too good of a view for a home. You can't ruin the view with a home. It's got to be shared.
Yeah,
and so that's where
I like
would
that philosophy.
That's where I would like very much to be able to build a tasting room.
Mm-hmm.
Is looking out over this view,
and maybe it's an outdoor tasting room. The way we're going, it'd be better.
It would be both.
Yeah,
it would be both.
Well, you mentioned, you know, one of my dreams is very similar to yours, Stu. You mentioned the Parthenon or the Acropolis, mm-hmm, or one of those amazing Greek structures. Imagine having a few columns giving a sense of structure, a few palm tree, a base, and just tables.
Yes.
In stone or wood, as you
right.
love to do. And people see the view and feel the energy that you've put into it.
I think the more that we let nature express itself, the better off we are. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes we can't force nature into our will, but fundamentally, nature is pretty damn interesting as it sits.
Yes.
And one of the things for me, I'm an outdoors person. There's nothing better than hiking the Sierra Nevadas, crossing over Kaweah Gap on the Great Western Divide, going up onto the Marble Mountains, the Trinity Alps, or canoeing back in the Northwoods of Minnesota and Canada. That's where my inspiration comes from.
Yeah, I can tell.
And that's where we learn to really have an ethics is in the outdoors. That you cannot live in this world and not feel a natural ethics except by being into the outdoors.
Entirely. And I've always said, Stu, I was born in Burgundy in Vougeot. My best friend, I always say, was Mother Nature. And
yes.
I think when we're in touch with her, she gives us so many folds what we have from life. And
yeah.
I think a lot more people, specifically these days with what we've gone through, want to be in touch with Mother Nature, want to go to the middle part of the US, want to go to parks, and want to rediscover nature. So maybe that's the good thing of what has happened.
It's hard, you know, being a scoutmaster, we have found that so many parents have never been into the outdoors.
That's it.
They're afraid of the outdoors, and thus they're afraid to let their little child go into the outdoors.
Yeah.
And that is so. And so these kids are all sitting at computers,
yeah,
and they don't even go to the parks, let alone the outdoors.
That's right.
And that is a real sadness. And hopefully, when this COVID-19 thing finally goes away, whenever, people will continue to want to get into the outdoors.
Exactly. I think we realized another dimension of connection, I think, to nature.
But it's also an ethics that you get in the outdoors that you can't get anywhere
else. Right.
And it's an inherent one. And it and you have to be just a stone hard cold to be in the outdoors and not feel what that ethics is. That it just is imbued into your character.
I'm with you. So, Stu, you brought an amazing wine that I'm dying to taste.
Yes.
So, I obviously finished my red wine.
Right.
Just as an excuse. Do a little rinse. It's an excuse to have more, you see. I don't have to rinse. Who needs to, but I'm going for it.
So, this is the 2016 Riesling. And it is a dry style Riesling.
Yeah, love it.
And I think it is, when we planted.
My style of Riesling.
When we planted, we were good, arrogant American boys, and we thought that we could do everything great. So we planted Pinot Noir and Cabernet Sauvignon and Riesling, Johannesburg Riesling, and Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And we got our lunch handed to us on Pinot Noir.
Yeah, well, it's not easy where you are, for sure.
It is not. And as
but
I like,
thank you for trying.
Well, and our argument at the time was that there was no California or New World Pinot Noirs that we could look to.
Yeah.
So we took a wild and crazy attitude toward this, which is that let's just be cavalier and not give a shit, because if we get so uptight, we won't try new interesting things.
That's it.
And I said, let's look at it as a search for the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it wouldn't be a perfect example, but it turned out to be a perfect example. We made one vintage, 1980, which was a good premier cru, but it was not a grand cru. And one vintage out of 12 does not an economic model make.
No,
and we are
as good as we'd like.
And when you are young and poor, you do not have the capital to pursue these great endeavors. And that's what Pinot Noir, it is a search for the Holy Grail.
But it's great because you pivoted quickly, but why Riesling?
Because why Riesling?
This is, dear friends, one of the best Riesling I've ever had in California. I don't say that too lightly, I did not know.
Well, let's hear these bring.
This is phenomenal, dear friends. Tell us why Riesling and why does it do so well up there?
Well, first of all, it's dry farm. Second of all, it's on the mountain. Mm. Third, we love Riesling. And if you as a grower don't love what you're doing, it shows up in the grapes, it shows up in the wine.
Yeah.
Riesling is one of the great wines of the world. Yeah. Not just one of the great white wines of the world, one of the great wines of the world. And what you get with it is the pure expression of the grape. So with Riesling, there is no malolactic fermentation. There is no French oak, American oak.
Yeah.
We don't have to worry about whether the oak came from
the Limousin or whatever.
Right. None of that stuff. We don't have to look at lee stirring. We want a pure expression of the grape. And this is what we get. And it is one of the most expressive grapes. Years and decades ago, Charlie and I thought, well, heck, we got Chardonnay, we got Riesling. Let's you know, be a little mad scientist here, you know, the sorcerer's apprentice. So we started adding Riesling to Chardonnay. Yeah. And we said, well, okay, let's try 10%. It's like, whoa, what happened to the Chardonnay? It went away.
Yeah.
We got all the way down to 1%. And it dominated.
Still at 1%.
At 1%, it dominated the Chardonnay. And what I have found out is that in these ensuing five decades, Riesling goes with everything.
Yeah.
There's no other wine that is more versatile.
Let me also
say one other thing, and that is for the money that you can buy a really good Riesling, you get so close to perfection.
Yeah.
If you buy a $60, $70 bottle of Cabernet, you're that far away from perfection.
How much does that one cost?
34.
Oh, dear friends, buy the case. How many bottles do you produce?
We do around 12 to 1300 cases.
That's amazing. This is stellar. So, Stu, the last question, the big one. What message would you have to all our friends, loving wine, loving life, who are with us tonight who are passionate about wine, but passionate about life in general. What's your ultimate message to the world? Big question.
Well, first of all, wine is the, for me, wine at a dining room table with family and friends is what makes the world, the world's problems go away.
Yes!
And I would also say that to anyone listening and goes, oh, I hate what I'm doing. I'd love to get into the wine business. And most everyone will say, don't do it. It's a stupid industry to get to. But let me also say that there is always room for a new idea, a fresh idea, a different approach. There's this wall that so many of us keep running into. And sometimes it's just easier to go around the wall, but we can't see where the wall ends.
That's it.
And so don't be inhibited by everyone saying no. If you are truly passionate about anything, drink what, well, here's the other thing I would say. And that is, from a wine point of view, drink what you like. Do not let anyone tell you. Don't read, don't drink the label. Trust yourself. Mm-hmm. If you taste something and you like it, God damn it, you like it. And if someone gives you a $2,500 bottle of wine and you don't like it, tough, you don't like it. That's okay.
Maybe you ask for a refund. So you drank the wine and you get $2,500.
Yeah, let the other guy pay for the refund. The issue is that wine is personal and you have to have the courage of your palate. Only you know what you like. And it's okay to like $2 Chuck. And it's okay not to like pick a, you know, $1,000 bottle of wine. Just trust yourself. Wine should be fun. And if you don't like what you're drinking, stop drinking and open something else.
I love it. Dear friends, the wise word of Stu Smith. I need to tell you, the only wine you need to really buy is Smith Madrone, because this is outstanding. And you bring in 1881 Napa too, because the combination of both. If you want to get into the wine world, become an ambassador too, because that's what we need in the wine world, is more great ambassadors and wine lovers. So, Stu, I want to thank you so much. One, for coming down the mountain. And everyone has seen now the beautiful pictures and the breathtaking estate that you have. Luckily, the antenna and the internet barely gets up there, so it makes it even more wild and a preserve. Congratulations for your commitment of half a century of phenomenal winemaking and great passion and great inspiration, and for being such a great environmentalist and passionate about Napa Valley and such a great winemaker.
Thank you.
See you soon, dear friends. Back tomorrow.